Historically speaking, human beings make a lot of mistakes. Some of those mistakes are small and relatively harmless. Someone burns their toast, or dials a wrong number, or announces the wrong winner of the Miss Universe pageant. But other mistakes are much more serious. Even when incredibly intelligent people are involved, even when it's the goal of those people to succeed and to not make mistakes, they still happen, more often than we might think. On September 23rd, 1999, the Mars Climate Orbiter was preparing to fulfill its mission of collecting data about the planet's atmosphere, climate, and surface. The mission was to last 2 years, and it was intended to help scientists learn more about the history of Mars climate, along with serving as a communications relay for future missions to the planet. This piece of equipment had cost $125 million, and its journey from Earth to Mars had taken over 9 months. Well, as this orbiter began its Mars orbit insertion burn, it was scheduled to reestablish contact with NASA after passing behind the planet. Instead, there was silence. NASA received no signal from the spacecraft, and just like that, it was gone. They conducted a thorough investigation, and NASA discovered that the probe failed because some of its software used English units instead of converting those to the metric system. And this simple mistake caused the orbiter to miss its intended orbit and to fall into the Martian atmosphere at about 35 miles in altitude. It disintegrated because of the atmospheric stress. And this $125 million mistake got by hundreds of NASA experts, even though an average high school physics student probably could have spotted the error. Is this the only example we could give? Not hardly. We could give countless examples of how human beings simply seem prone to these kinds of problems. For example, Boeing, a company that designs, manufactures, and sells airplanes, among other things, says that 80% of all airplane accidents are the result of human error. In other words, in 8 out of 10 cases, a person made a mistake and a plane crashed. The Titanic sank on April 15, 1912, because a human being misjudged the distance between an iceberg and the ship's hull. Over 1,500 people died as a result of that mistake. The Three Mile Island incident, which occurred on March 28, 1979, and was the most significant accident in U.S. commercial nuclear power plant history, was caused by a mistaken human response to the partial meltdown of one of the plant's nuclear reactors. This accident caused $2.4 billion in property damage and led to sweeping changes in the industry. Now, what does any of this have to do with evidence for the Bible's inspiration? You're about to find out in today's lesson.
I do appreciate everybody that's been able to be with us this week, and hope that it's been encouraging to you and to your families as we are not so much challenged, but hopefully reminded of good lessons that remind us why we can trust the Bible, why we can have confidence in it. And one of the things that I've been reminded as I've listened to Royce the last two nights is we're only touching the skim of the surface in many of these things, and there's much more that we can dig into. But hopefully they have whetted your appetite a little bit, that you want to go and maybe learn some more about some of these things. But when you talk about the archaeological evidence, as he did on Monday night, we talk about predictive prophecy and the promises that come true hundreds of years before those events took place, and now we even have more archaeological evidence that shows us these weren't fabrications years after they happened, but were written well before these events came to take place. They all remind us, how did these things happen? They happened by process of inspiration. As God revealed this unto man, that's why you can trust it. And that's where we go again tonight. So we look at some of the scientific evidence, and again, merely scratching the surface of some of the things that we could talk about, but talking about scientific evidence or reasoning, why I can trust the Bible. And we start with that concept that certainly we are known to make mistakes. We all, from time to time, get something out of order. We make some mistake. We assume that we know one thing and it turns out to be something else. We state something as fact and then maybe learn a little bit more and have to understand, oh, that was not correct. Now I understand that this is correct. Make mention of scientists, very knowledgeable people that have studied in their fields and gotten PhDs and spent years in research, and they'll write books and then come back and have to revise those books. Have to come back and put out a second edition, a third edition, a fourth edition. It was always interesting. You look at your textbooks as you're going through school. Maybe grab your kids' textbooks sometime and just look. What edition are they on? Very rarely are you going to find they're on the first edition of a book. It's already gone through a number of different revisions. And yet you pause and you think about the Bible. How many times has it been revised? Not a one. It's been translated. There may be some things that we've understood about it a little bit more, but there's been no need for a revision. There's been no need for a correction because it has been true and it has stood the test of time. And even as we're going to see tonight, we're taking us from a time in which, you know, we're going back through what is commonly and typically referred to as dark ages. We're going back into times in which there were just many things that we didn't know, we didn't understand. And yet the Bible addressed these things and addresses them accurately. And we wonder, how is all of that possible? Because of a Creator. Because we have one who was inspiring men, revealing truth to them that they could know these things. And so we think, I'll be like Royce. I'll follow primarily the pattern and just know that we have more than we could get to in an hour and a half, and we don't even have an hour and a half. So we'll see what we can do tonight. But just thinking about this process of human error, understanding, and we're just referring to a person's mistake as opposed to that of a machine. Even machines that are programmed and follow a rote process. Even sometimes there are errors and mistakes there, but we're talking about a person's mistake. It's a judgment or an action that was unintentional, unexpected, or undesired. And so sometimes even with the best intentions, we still find ourselves making mistakes. There's an estimate that in 2016, there were some 250,000 deaths directly result of just medical error. And that's here in the United States alone, where go into the great discussions, but we have fairly good medical facilities, very smart doctors, and yet we still make a lot of mistakes. We still have problems and difficulties that arise. Even it's been reported that some 60 to 80% of failures, accidents, and incidents and high-risk injuries are due to human error. That's at least in part why in many places you look to automation. You look to letting machines do things that have sensors that are alert, and they have their own warnings. But many times it's much safer to get that human operating and helping a machine and repairing it and letting the machine go and do the work that is not only less prone to mistake, but then you don't have the consequential damage or hurt that maybe comes to a human individual when something does go wrong either. And so it just underscores for us that, yes, even though we're a fairly smart and intelligent people, we still make a lot of mistakes. We're people that have learned a lot of things, but we still have much that we don't understand. So when we compare that and we begin thinking about the Bible, then we get to looking at a book that lies before us, and we say, well, what is this book? Well, it's very old. This is not a book that was recently produced with all of the advances in medical technology and knowledge and understanding and all of these things. This is an ancient book. Statement here is that the first books of the Bible, as we think about Moses writing in the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, penned somewhere around 1450 BC by Moses. Personal opinion, I'd put the book of Job as actually written even before that, though we have a little more accuracy in dating Moses' life and the time in which he was writing. So it gives us a start to think back. Here we are in 2025, and we're looking at some writings that stretch all the way back, not just 2,025 years ago, but then you have to add the 1,450 years before that. And I'm not great at math, but I think that is 3,475 years ago, roughly, that you have Moses writing, and he's dealing accurately in the things that he's describing and prescribing to God's people. That's fairly, lack of a better word, fairly mind-blowing when we consider that time. When you go to the opposite end, you think about where the Bible ends with the book of Revelation, wrapped up by the end of the first century. So even if you're just taking the time of the actual Bible writing, you have a time period here of some 1,550 years over which the Bible was written. We'll deal a little bit more with that tomorrow night. But even that, this book is one whose conclusion was written some 1,925 years ago. And so again, you think about all that we've learned, you think about all that we've discovered, you think about all that the advances that we've made. What would we expect of the Bible? Well, we look at some propositions in this concept. As you think about it, you have to understand, if, I would have put that in big, bold, flashing letters, if, there's your proposal, if the Bible was written by humans, what would you expect? We have some of the brightest scientific minds with the ability to do spell check and language check and all of these things, and we still can't write a perfect book. Well, we still have revisions. We still have things that we understand I have to learn and grow in. And so I would expect if, as some claim, that the Bible is just a book of man's creation, something that we set forth, I'd expect to find all kinds of mistakes and errors and the need for correction that we find in other human books. I'm certainly going to expect to find a lot of outdated information. Well, that's what they knew and understood at that time. And we could give them a little leeway for that understanding. They were written as they knew these things to be. But that's what you would expect if this was simply written by man. And so that's what a lot of the world around us says. This is just a book of man. It's a creation of man. It has all of these errors. It has all of these shortcomings. And it cannot agree with our scientific minds. We know too much. We understand too much. We've discovered too much. And so the Bible's a quaint little book that was written by ignorant men many, many, many years ago. But it's just a cute little fairy tale these days. Again, we don't know so much more. That's what you would expect if this were simply written by man, that you couldn't have these two things agreeing. And so that's one proposition that you have to consider or hold on one hand. But if the Bible is as it claims to be, and if the Bible is what it says it is, if it was truly guided and directed and inspired by a creator of all of the world, the one who designed and put into place all of the things that we have and enjoy and indeed created our very lives and revealed this message to us, what then would we expect if that were the case? And so you have the, if you will, the unbeliever's proposal, but now you have the proposal of the believer or the proposal of the Bible that claims it is accurate. Now, as we talk about these things, here's another principle that I think helps us or that we ought to understand. When I'm talking about the Bible as being scientifically accurate or historically accurate and all of these things, I think we need to understand the Bible is not a science textbook. The Bible is not a historical textbook. That's not what we open it up. You're not going to necessarily open it and say, okay, we're going to get our science lesson out of the Bible today. Now, there's certainly places that you could go and you could learn a lot of good things and you could apply certain principles and learn some things concerning the creation and what God designed and put into place and the laws that he set into motion. You could certainly do that. But that's not how it's written. It's not just a collection of facts. What we're talking about as we speak about these things is as you read the Bible and as the Bible is speaking, it's not claiming to present this as a textbook format, but it's accurate in the things that it speaks of. It's correct in the things that it speaks of. And that's what we would expect if indeed it is written by the Creator of all of the world. And so we should expect agreement between the scientific statements of the Bible that it makes and the things concerning the world in which we observe and the things that we have even come to know. Not only that, as we specifically talk about some of the things we'll try to look at tonight, if this is created or written by the Creator of all of the world, one who set all of these things into motion, not only would you expect it to be accurate in the things that it spoke of, you'd kind of expect that it revealed things to us. And so when we talk about scientific foreknowledge of the Bible, there are things that we know today that we've discovered, that we have researched and learned and understood certain principles that now we have been able to apply to our practices. And as we have done so, we've learned and grown. And some of these things we can stop and look back and say, well, the Bible spoke accurately concerning some of these things, or the Bible dealt with some of these principles. Again, some 2,000 years plus ago, 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, as it spoke concerning these things. And so we would expect that we have a book before us that contains no falsehoods, no mistakes, no erroneous claims as you look at the Bible as it's been revealed to us. So as you then try to nail down into that or drill down into that, okay, what are we talking about? What are some examples that we might look at? And so we'll approach it in this way. Let's consider some proofs, if you will, some scientific concepts that the Bible spoke of, again, from the time in which it was written, not needing correction or revision, and now we understand these things all the more. Well, one is going to be the law of biogenesis. This is one that man still debates, still talks about. But biogenesis, we talk about the idea here of a compound word, bio meaning life. Think about biology, study of life, study of living things. So bio meaning life and genesis meaning creation or beginning. Where did life come from? Where did life begin? That's a problem that's going to plague man as long as he looks to his own wisdom throughout all of time. We still have people that say, well, if we get just the right combination of amino acids, and if we mix it in just the right setting and in just the right environment, and we provide just the right electrical charge, we might see some spark of that which we might be able to identify as some form of life. And there's all kinds of problems that you can go through as you think about those things. Number one, you cheated. You say, well, what do you mean? How did you cheat? Well, you started with the things that were already made. Go get your own materials. Go create your own out of nothing. And then still provide that spark of life. But you not only have that problem, you have the problem of that very simple life form that you still have to take from that setting all the way through. And yet what man has looked at and actually proven time and time again continues to remind us that life comes from life. Life springs forth of life that's been, if you will, created of its own kind. That God set that in motion, and that's how He's spoken of it. So you have studies such as scientists as Louis Pasteur that had a number of scientific studies that were going to point out the fact that no, indeed, life didn't just spontaneously generate. It just didn't come forth out of nothing, but rather this principle proven time and again that it has come forth from something living. And so that reminder, natural life, never been created from something non-living. It can't be produced in the scientific lab. It can't be made out of nothing. And so you take a lot of smart men that have had all of these experiments, all of these plannings, and yet time and time again, they continue to find you cannot create life out of nothing. It doesn't spring forth that way. And so that's something we've had to discover. We have had to learn. And yet the Bible spoke about that again for over 3,500 years. You go back and you think about some of those earliest writings. We're thinking back to 1450, somewhere around there, as B.C., as Moses is writing. And as he speaks concerning the creation of life, Genesis 1, and verse 24, where did life come from? God spoke. The Bible spoke about that spark of life, that Genesis of where it came from. Not only that, as you continue in the book of Genesis, you're going to find that things produced after their own kind. And we continue to see that pattern throughout time. Things creating after their own kind. That's the pattern we see that agrees with where life came from. And so God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind. Cattle, creeping thing, beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so, and it's a pattern that then continued, has continued throughout time. So life itself, biogenesis. But then also in, if you will, study of science, study of physics, the understanding of matter and of the universe. Again, man had a lot of ideas, a lot of creation, a lot of thoughts on the universe, how things came to be, how things have continued since the beginning of time. And so when we think about thermodynamics, we're talking here of a study of matter and energy and how these things relate. Man didn't always understand this. We maybe had the concept, well, things produce their own energy. There's been thoughts of the idea of a continuous creation in which energy constantly has to be pumped into a system. But what we've come to know, what we've come to learn, that the Bible has always agreed with, is that matter and energy can change forms. Within a closed system, matter and energy can change forms, but it's neither created nor destroyed. And we see that all around us. even when we don't always understand it or know exactly what's happening. If I burn a piece of paper, I think, well, that matter was destroyed because I'm not left with the same substance that I was when I began. And yet, what happened in that process? Oh, yes, that matter changed forms. There's still matter that's left in a slightly different form, but it also released a certain amount of energy in terms of heat and light. And so there was energy and that was changing forms, but nothing was really created or destroyed again within a closed system. We'll come back to that in just a moment. That's that first law of thermodynamics. You can change form, but it can't be created or destroyed. Likewise, the second law of thermodynamics reminds us that closed systems are moving towards a state of entropy, of disorder. Again, everything around us screams this. If you live in a house of any sort, I don't care whether you own it, whether you rent it, what happens? Something goes wrong. Something breaks. Something needs painted. Something needs kept up. Something needs cleaning. We're constantly moving in that sense, just as a visualization, to a state of disorder. Something being less usable, if you will, than it was before. Our automobiles do this. Our clothes do this. These things wear out, and if you will, decay or wear down. And so, what did God have to say about these matters? Well, from the very beginning, the Bible agrees with that first law of thermodynamics as it speaks concerning the creation of the world. Moses, again, writing somewhere around that 1450 B.C. mark in Genesis chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. It's an important concept. On the seventh day, God ended His work, which He had done, and He rested on the seventh day from all of His work, which He had done. It's not a continuous creation process. It's not God continually pumping energy into the closed system that He had created, but in fact, He set it up. I want to be very careful there. I'm not at all suggesting, as the deist does, that, well, God set up a system, he set it in motion, and God went to sleep. No, God was still concerned with His creation, still concerned with His people. We see that throughout the biblical account. But in terms of creation, he was done. It was created. He set these laws and these motions into fact. And so the energy creation process was done there at the close of day six. Even a number of statements throughout the Bible are going to remind us of the second law of thermodynamics. This concept of things wearing down in Hebrews chapter 1. God is writing here, revealing by inspiration a statement that, again, agrees with that second law of thermodynamics. Hebrews 1, verse 10 and 11. You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth. The heavens are the work of Your hands. They will perish, but You remain. They will all grow old like a garment. There is a wearing out. There is an aging process that is a natural part of being in this world. Now, not only are they going to end in the sense that one day God's going to say, that's enough, time's over, but even just in the process of time and in the process of things, life and the things of this world, they all wear out. And so, again, what we're merely attempting to point out is that these are accurate statements from a people that are writing them hundreds and thousands of years before we prove them, if you will. We were able to describe them. We were able to set them forth scientifically. Another example. We might think about the countless stars. Somebody turn and read for us Genesis chapter 1 and verse 16. It's probably one of my, one of my favorite verses of the Bible among many, but it's certainly one of the favorites concerning what God was able to do and accomplish concerning the creation. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 16. When you stop and you look at what God made, and you consider the world in which we live, it's an amazing creation. And the wonderful thing is, you can take the microscope and you can zoom in as far as we can tell and we can discover. And it's amazing intricacies of all that God did and designed. But now maybe you go the other direction. If you could take the smallest thing that man could ever see with whatever electron microscopes or scientific instruments that we could ever create, you go from that sub-microscopic scale, and you go all the way out, and you picture the biggest telescope that God could create. And you look as far as you can into outer space, and we keep on learning more and more concerning the universe that surrounds us, concerning galaxies and stars and things that are happening. And man, you zoom out to that level, and we seem almost insignificant in a grand sense. But you look through all of those things, and all of them have great marks of design. All of them have great intricacies of how these things work. And one of the things I love, God has given us a mind with which we think and we investigate and we discover. You know what? We've discovered a lot of scientific principles of how these things work and interoperate. We'll go with that. How they work together. And that doesn't decrease and say, oh, that's just a mechanism. Now that I understand it, it's not very interesting. I don't do that. I look and I see, no, that was amazing intricacies that could not be put in place by man. It couldn't be put in place by accident. And so I'm seeing all of these things that exist and all of these things that are created, and I'm amazed at the wonder of God. But we think here about the stars, and why I love that statement. I got off on that, but think of all of that amazing stuff. And God really addresses it in one chapter. Genesis chapter 1. We don't have a lot of details. God doesn't do a lot to toot his own horn, if you will, or to proclaim the majesties of all that he made. He left that for us to discover. And we've done a lot of that. And we've been able to see some wonderful things. It's dealt with very matter-of-factly, very simply. As just stated, here is what God did. And so it's amazing enough to think about the great light that he made to rule the day, the sun, and the lesser light to rule the night also, speaking about the moon. And I don't mean to be flippant, but you stop and think, oh yeah, he made the stars also. Well, the stars are pretty impressive things. And there's still a lot we don't understand and know about stars. But he threw them out there for us too. No, this is a wonderful part of his creation, and get such a passing phrase. But then you think of how he uses those expressions even later. Speaking to Abraham, God comes to him a time later in his life and begins to give him great and precious promises. And even to the point, Abraham, you're going to be a great nation. Well, that's pretty impressive for a guy that doesn't even have a child yet. And he says, who's that going to be? I mean, I've got Eliezer, my servant. Are his children going to be inherited after me, and it's through him that these things? No, got to work that out. But he speaks in Genesis chapter 15 And verse 5, then he, that is God, brought him outside, said, look now towards heaven, count the stars, if you are able to number him, and said to him, so shall your descendants be, if you are able to number them. God set forth a fairly significant principle there. Can you imagine Abraham, David is a young shepherd, these men sitting out in the Middle East, they don't have the light pollution that we struggle with today. A little over a year ago, we went down to Big Bend, first time I had been in that area, and known as the dark sky or whatever they call that area. It was truly impressive to just sit there. And every now and then, way off in the distance, you can tell there's a city over there with a lot of lights. But for the most part, a very dark area. And so you're able to see up on a clear night and see so many wonderful stars with just even the naked eye. And you stop and think, that's probably all that Abraham had. That's probably all that David had. They were able to stare up and wonder at what God had made. And even to them, that was a vast number. Something uncomprehendable. Okay, let me stop. Okay, that was 1, 2, 3. I get past 10. I have to take off my shoes. I get to 20. I'm lost. I can't go any further. And then I look down and where was I? Okay, let's start back at that bright one. 1, 2. You can't number the stars. And somewhat we'll think about this again. Even with so much of our scientific advancement, what do? We just keep finding more and more stars. Well, what about man? When we think about man, for a long time, even up into the 1900s, we had a concept. There was a very limited number of stars. And people put forth some counts. Here's a Hipparchus that's going to estimate. Well, there's probably between 800 and 1,080 stars. Again, when we stop and we think about just what the human eye can see, and it's a vast landscape, but there's a lot we don't know. And of course, even at that point of time, not understanding, hey, I'm only looking one direction. I got to look in all directions to see all of the stars. But had a rather limited count of the stars, and so a lot of ancients had this concept, maybe around 1,000 stars. Even Chang Heng put the number around 2,500, not including those which the sailors observed. The idea is, that's a fairly limited, fairly small number of stars. Again, I can't count to 2,000. I mean, I guess I could if you stuck me in a room and if I could stay awake that long. But I'm going to struggle trying to count 2,000 individual stars. But there was this concept. The stars are limited in number. There's some concept that we can grasp the idea of stars. I don't even believe God necessarily was telling us there is an infinite number of stars. Certainly, I believe this is a hyperbolic statement in terms of they are so vast. You won't be able to count them. And he's giving this promise to Abraham. Abraham, I know you're small. You're insignificant. You feel worthless maybe at this sense. I have no descendants, but I'm going to give you this great nation. Yes. And you're going to be a people. You're going to be a nation beyond count. Well, that doesn't mean they couldn't actually take a census and have an understanding of the people. But it was going to swell so greatly. And then you think about what we know and what we've discovered and what we've looked into. And still, now we say there are at least thousands of billions of stars. As we look into the outer space, into the universe, and with the tools and the things that we have available to us, we realize, no, the numbering of the stars is indeed, if you will, beyond number. And so the Bible was accurate in these things when man was thinking, well, we have a fairly limited concept and number of the stars. No, we hadn't even scratched the surface. And so the Bible was right in those areas. A few years ago, a year or two maybe, must have been two or three, we talked about the ark. Always an interesting one as you consider God's instructions unto Noah to go forth and to build an ark to the saving of his household. And he doesn't just say, go build what you think you need. No, he gives him very specific instructions, and he says, you go build the ark 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, 30 cubits high, somewhere around 450 feet by 75 feet by 45 feet. Noah, you go build a big box, essentially, is what Noah is tasked with. Well, it's interesting because what you really wind up with is a perfect ratio for some shipbuilding. Now, let's be careful. Somebody laughs and says, no, that's a horrible ship. It'll never go anywhere. Where did you have to go? The whole face of the earth is covered in water. I'm not getting there fast, and I'm not going to know where I am even if I'm there. All of the mountain peaks even are covered with water. We're not building a race boat. We're building a cargo carrying boat. That's its purpose. That's what it is attempting to serve. And now what we know is you go into World War II. Again, a lot of shipbuilders through time. We have some concepts of building boats, and you've got the Vikings earlier, and you've got others that are out there building boats and ships and improving upon them. But you come into World War II, and very similar specifications are going to be used to create what we know as the SS Jeremiah O'Brien, called the Ugly Duckling, for a good purpose. It ain't a pretty ship. It's ugly, but it serves its purpose. It's a cargo-carrying ship. It's not built for speed. It's built for its ability to carry cargo, and tremendous amounts of it at that. Again, you stop and you look and say, well, that's impressive. Man used his mathematical abilities. He used his figuring and figures out these things. But God knew what he was doing when he gave instructions unto Noah. And so we spent a year looking at Noah and the ark in one of our studies, and part of it was looking at even the building of the ark. Well, what about sewage? Not a concept we necessarily like to talk about, but we live in a fairly hygienic society. But you know, still upon the face of the earth, there's a lot of unhygienic places. There's a lot of places that are still struggling with disease and sickness because of not really having the ability or the knowledge of how to deal with the waste that they have. We've got humanitarian groups that are going out into the world figuring out ways in which to help trap and waste and trash that's filling up in lakes and rivers and even parts of the oceans because for years we just used the earth as a trash can. Well, it became problematic. And indeed, in certain times and places, it became very problematic. We understand, look, we've got to deal in a sanitary way with the waste and disposal of our trash and even human waste. But how many millions of people have died because we didn't really always understand that? Because we would open the window and throw a bucket of waste right out the window and it lands in the street, and then we're walking in it, and ladies, your dresses are dragging in it, and all of our shoes are walking in it. And then we come and walk into our house, and we're always around it. Then you start having problems in England with rats and rodents that are dwelling in all of that and coming into the house. It's just a nasty environment. And so you have the London cholera epidemic of 1846. 16,000 people died because we don't understand the simple truth of having to be hygienic and properly dispose of our waste and try to be a clean people. Moses, go down into Egypt, and I want you to bring an innumerable people up out of Egypt. I believe it could have well surpassed maybe even the 2 million people. Mark, you go out into the wilderness and you wander around with him. You've got quite a problem. But God even addressed part of this problem there in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 12. It talks about going outside of the camp where you shall take an implement among your equipment. Take a shovel. When you sit down, dig with it, turn, and cover your waist. God was dealing with the problems of waste 3,000 years before some of the epidemics and the problems that we dealt with in terms of having to deal with human waste and sewage. I thought I'd be further. I'm going to speed a little quicker through some of this. There's plenty of others, and there's things that we might talk about that aren't even contained within the book, but when you think about through all of this, God was dealing in a way with his people that would help protect them and shelter them. And there are things that they were dealing with and that he was revealing to them. What we're showing is before man knew how to deal with these things themselves, before they were probably handling this. And so when you look at our society, there's still a lot we don't know about properly handling sanitation and quarantines and medical procedures that would help people. And yet there's a lot of good medical advice, even within the books of the Pentateuch, specifically in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, as God's revealing his law to his people and telling them how to act and how to live, that surpassed the knowledge of that day. You stop and think about Moses. He was raised in all of the knowledge of Egypt. So he took a people out into the wilderness and taught them the Egyptians' way of hygiene. No. This surpassed the Egyptians, certainly surpassed most of what was known within the world at that time. And so he's speaking of things concerning modern medicine, really didn't grasp maybe up to 3,500 years later. Blood, there's a principle of the Old Testament spelled out very strong for us in the book of Leviticus. The life is in the blood. We didn't understand that. You go back just a few hundred years ago, and we're thinking about blood as the problem. Blood is that which is containing or carrying all of these diseases. And so what's the answer to a lot of these problems? Well, get rid of it. Bleed it off. And so as you look, we now understand more about the blood and the circulatory system, that indeed it carries oxygen throughout the body. It's necessary for life, for reproduction within our bodies. And so you cannot live without it, making all of the functions of the human body possible. And let you go back into the Middle Ages, up into the 19th century, and we talk about vapors. Well, these vapors will enter into the blood and cause sickness. And so if we want to deal with it, hey, throw some leeches on that person. Let them suck out the blood of that person, and maybe they'll take the illness with them. And so they would cut the arteries and allow the blood to come out of the arm to try to get rid of this contaminated blood. You've got George Washington even that's going to die because, hey, we don't really know what to do with him. Hey, let's try to bleed him a little bit. Well, you bled him pretty much to death. And yet what do we have? Leviticus 17 and verse 11. Thousands of years earlier, life is in the blood. There was an important principle that Moses understood by inspiration of God here these many years before. Soap. It's interesting as you look through the law of Moses, and he talks about some of the cleansing agents for the clean and the unclean. There's a recipe, if you will, given in Numbers 19 and verse 6, taking of cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet, casting them in the midst of the burning fire, casting them into the midst of the fire burning the heifer. And those who are unclean can go and wash. In essence, that recipe is not that much different from lye soap. You have a very cleansing agent. So what happened? The priest goes and he looks at somebody and he says, you've got a problem. You're unclean. You're going to be removed from the city while you're in this state, quarantined to help. But it was a quarantine of the sick people. You're going to go outside, and after 3 days, you're going to wash. You're going to be inspected. After 7 days, you're going to wash. taking the soap and cleansing yourself, and you have those principles here, even within the Old Testament. Quarantine, again, outside of the camp, you have the lepers of Leviticus chapter 13, 45, removed so that they didn't spread those diseases. And if they did come in contact with you, like when you cough or sneeze, cover your mouth. I'm unclean. Don't get near me. I don't want to spread this to someone else. So even the principles of quarantine are there within the pages of the Bible. Again, thousands of years. Food consumption, particularly clean and unclean animals. And many of those unclean animals, we still now understand you have to treat them very carefully. Cook them very well. Well, God made provision. Hey, there's certain clean and unclean foods that you can and cannot eat. There are more. One of the things I'm going to suggest to you, the chapter wraps up. There are certainly some problems that man points out from time to time. Well, maybe this statement or that statement's wrong. We need to be careful from time to time. I'm always going to warn you of being careful of Facebook claims. Somebody points something out, ooh, that sounds good, and you share it. Well, there's no basis for it. There are certainly also things that over time our understanding has grown, but God's Word didn't change. Maybe how we understood a word changed, but it still fits the scientific evidence that's all around us. And so we have a book that we can trust in and we can rely in. What I'm going to remind you is we just barely scratched that surface. And so hopefully you'll want to keep learning and growing in that. And so we're going to pause. If you want, of course, there's some cookies and snacks and drink, Kool-Aid or water or something there in the back, and you're welcome to do that. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be back in here to wrap up. Hope that you can be with us tomorrow night as well. We're going to be looking at the concept of the unity of the Bible. Again, we kind of hit on some of that tonight, but you take the great variety of the authors and the times, and we still have a solid unitary book. And so we'll try to look at some of those things, Lord willing, tomorrow night. Thank you for your time.